The Guardian.
This is Politics Weekly. I'm Heather Stewart. This week,
while the talks take place in a constructive atmosphere, discussions have been difficult.
It's crunch time again. With Brexit negotiations at a standstill and the vote on May's deal due next week, what are its chances and what on earth happens if it doesn't get through? Also this week, Labour's Jess Phillips was less than happy when her son's school told her it was considering closing early to save costs.
I am going to coach up all of the children and I'm going to leave my own son with the police officers at Downing Street.
We catch up with her to find out why more and more schools are cutting their hours and what she plans to do about it. And with Theresa May's days likely to be numbered, how many members of the Cabinet are on manoeuvres? We assess the runners and riders jostling to be the next Tory leader. That's all in this week's Politics Weekly. But first, it's just 22 days, 22 days until we leave the EU, and last-minute negotiations with Brussels are reportedly robust, i.e. going nowhere. With the vote on May's deal looming, no solution to the Irish border problem in sight, and a vanishingly small chance of Attorney General Geoffrey Cox being able to change his legal advice to reassure Tory Brexiters, where does this leave May, the Tories and the rest of us? Well, I'm joined to discuss all this by Jonathan Friedland from The Guardian, Stephanie Lloyd from Labour pressure group Progress and Rachel Wolfe, partner at consultancy Public First and former advisor to David Cameron. So, Jonathan, I feel like I've written umpteen times in the last 6-9 months that there's a crunch coming up in Brexit.
We've all got a little F key on our keyboard now where we press F6 or something and it says crunch week coming in Brexit. It just saves time.
But it does feel as if next week is a moment, doesn't it? Meaningful vote too?
It does. I don't know whether it's going to be the final decisive moment. I'm with people who think that maybe there's the theatre around this moment as being the crunch. It then perhaps goes down and then allows the real panic to set in, which prepares the ground for an 11th hour, really 11th hour, in the final week, for Theresa May to come back with the deal a third time, with everyone realising it's that or the cliff, or that or delay, or that or no Brexit, and all the usual arguments. But it's definitely a big deal, and I think it's the biggest crunch since the January 15th first meaningful vote. I think all the rest in between has been the phony war. I mean, the one thing we castigate ourselves for not knowing, when people ask us what's going to happen, and we often have to say, well, I'm sorry, I don't know. The thing I would always say to listeners and to reassure colleagues is the practitioners themselves don't know. The players themselves don't know how this is going to work out. They really don't. The whips don't know the exact numbers. Even if they can roughly game out the actual outcome of the vote on Tuesday, which I don't think they can, the consequences of that, the next steps, anybody's guess. So I don't think you should listen to anyone who makes actual predictions, but the scenario that says this is the final week and it will all be sorted and, you know, a week from now we'll know, I don't buy that.
Rachel, what we've seen in recent weeks a little bit is the sort of Remainy wing of the Conservative Party, or the ex-Remain wing, they probably call themselves, of the Conservative Party, asserting themselves a bit more, isn't it? We've heard so much from the ERG and the Brexiters in the past kind of couple of years, but we're starting to see a little bit that cabinet ministers and others on the other wing of the party are feeling quite strongly and are on manoeuvres a bit.
Yeah, I mean, you've obviously got both ex-Remainers in the government and in Parliament who are trying to use Parliament to force decisions. I think the thing that's quite worrying to me, because we do focus groups pretty much every week on Brexit, is that at the moment, you cannot underestimate how little the public have noticed about most of these shenanigans, right? Like, they kind of know that it's a bit chaotic and Theresa May's trying to keep going, but they have zero idea about the detail or which Conservatives are pushing, or even that there's a big split. And the point at which they really notice, because they're simply not prepared for it right now, is if there's a delay. And at the point at which there's a delay, I think for the first time, you're going to start seeing some genuine anger and frustration aimed at the Tory party that they've pretty much managed to avoid so far, because people just think Brexit's going to happen. It looks like it's a bit of a mess. And beyond that, they haven't really noticed anything, because let's face it, most of the details are quite boring and procedural, and the sort of things that people who like talking about by-election 1982 like to talk about, they're not something that most of the public likes to pay attention to. So we haven't actually really hit public anger, even if we're seeing shifting polls yet. I think it's going to hit in the next month or so.
And Stephanie, it'll matter quite a lot in that case, whom the public blame for this delay, won't it? There's quite a lot of what's going on at the moment, it seems to me, is everyone sort of stepping back a bit and trying not to take responsibility for what happens next.
Yeah, I think that's very clear when it comes to the leadership of both parties in trying to kind of push blame onto the other. Theresa May's constant line of, well, the only way you're going to not have no deal is by voting for my deal. And then the Labour leadership being like, but this is an awful deal, so why would we do this? And I think you will see a huge amount of kind of dancing around the edges. Obviously, we saw kind of Jeremy Corbyn meeting with Conservative members of Parliament, people like Oliver Letwin, which was obviously, you know, quite out of step from his normal way of working across the Commons, or more to the point, his lack of working across the Commons. But I think, you know, this is when there needs to be a real level of leadership from him. And I think it's quite clear that the concessions that Theresa May is trying to come back with, one, won't happen, and two, the ones that she's trying to use then in terms of bringing Labour MPs on side with her also aren't going to work. The kind of phony, very thin workers' rights deals that she's trying to hand across aren't going to be enough to bring any Labour MP that probably wasn't already going to vote with her anyway.
Jonathan, that meeting was quite interesting yesterday, wasn't it? Such an unlikely combination of people. Jeremy Corbyn, who's, as Stephanie said, doesn't work cross-party very often, sitting there with, you know, former Tory ministers and talking about a sort of softer Brexit. We were told a week or two ago that Labour's position has shifted and that a second referendum was now the thing. So what's going on there?
I think your starting point has to be that the leadership really don't want a second referendum. And they know that they're lugging around as a millstone this conference resolution, which, by the way, has got, you know, so many loopholes in it, you can drive right through it. But they keep having to say it's on the table. But that doesn't mean they're going to pick it up off the table if it's just there. So they don't want it for all electoral reasons, ideological reasons, all kinds of reasons why they don't want it. They think it's bad news for them. And therefore, really, I think it's right that their ideal scenario is that Brexit does go through, it is dragged across the line, but without their fingerprints on it, so they don't get blamed. I mean, you asked the question about blame, and I think they want as little blame as possible. Therefore, behind that meeting is, with Bowles and Letwin, is, I think, the desire to see if there is something that can just haul across the line, and then also to make sure that it's still not a Labour initiative, you know, to put it over into Theresa May's lap rather than their lap. I think that remains the objective. You know, the resolution says, and then we'll go to a second referendum, as if, you know, we'll have to run through all these other things, but that's the thing we want. That's how Remainers on the Labour conference floor saw it. Actually, it was, that really is the absolute last resort, the thing we don't want to do. And once you see it that way, I think you understand what they're doing.
Even though we're already in March. Rachel, how would those members of the public that you've been talking to and listening to react, do you think, if politicians at Westminster said, we can't solve this, we're going to have to ask you again, we're going to have to not have another referendum, or heaven forbid, another general election?
So I guess the obvious response is it depends which members of the public, because every party, this is why there's these endless fudges and delays, every party is in a really bad electoral position, because every party is facing major schisms within their traditional electorates that they simply cannot resolve over Brexit. So there's no good incentive to come up with a really clear position, certainly on the Labour side. I think the disastrous scenario, certainly from the kind of swing voters that we talk to, is if they feel they've been lied to, right? It's betrayal that is the really key kind of swing point. So if the response is, we are seeking a second referendum because we think we'll get Remain this time, if that sort of seems to be what people feel, their view is, we were lied to and we were betrayed, and then they never vote for that party again, ever. I think almost any scenario in electoral terms is better than that.
So that suggests, Stephanie, that there's a genuine concern or a sort of realistic problem behind Labour's reluctance to move towards a second referendum, doesn't it? Labour's electoral coalition involves Leavers and Remainers, although it's more Remain than Leave. They're worried about this idea of betrayal, aren't they, in sort of core seats of theirs?
Well, they are, but I think the thing that's more important to remember is, I think even if all of the evidence, and largely, to be fair, almost all of the evidence does show that it actually wouldn't really damage Labour that much in terms of its electoral problems, even Labour kind of leave voters, it's not the top of their priorities in terms of what they want to happen. They care far more about what's happening with the NHS, what's happening with education. It is not the thing that they are going to feel the most betrayed by. There is a huge ideological reason at the top of the current leadership of the Labour Party as to why they don't want us to go towards any form of second referendum, or why they don't really want to oppose Brexit in any way. And it is quite plainly true that Jeremy Corbyn is a man who, I think, had he not been leader of the Labour Party, would have quite happily campaigned for us to leave. And there is that part of that where, actually, this is where the kind of real betrayal narrative will come in when it comes to Jeremy Corbyn, which is Labour members on large, and by far on large, want us to remain, want us to move towards a second referendum. And I think it's also Labour voters aren't going to forgive the Labour Party when they realise the kind of realities of what just delivering Brexit, and particularly delivering a Tory Brexit, is actually going to mean to their day-to-day lives. And that's where I think the real betrayal is going to start to come in, and that's the part that the Labour leadership are currently missing out when it looks at their analysis of this. And Labour MPs are very clear. They don't want to back a Tory Brexit. And even the ones who are quite sceptical about a second referendum still are not desperate to run through the lobbies with Tory MPs to get that deal over the line for Theresa May. So I think we're going to end up, as you say, in a kind of situation where we know kind of what might happen next week, but we don't know the consequences of what that will be.
I think it's both Stephanie and Rachel are right about this betrayal thing. It's really interesting because it's different for different parties. So the betrayal myth that the Tories need to avoid is, you promised us Brexit and didn't give it to us. But there's a whole parallel betrayal myth, which Stephanie was just talking about, which is Labour members, particularly activists, but voters too, some of them will say, you know, you're meant to be a pro-European party. How did you enable this thing? So either side faces this risk of betrayal. I just want to echo what Stephanie was saying about this premise that a lot of Labour people seem to be operating on, which is, oh my word, we can't do anything to those Labour Leave voters. They will be so angry with us and accused of betrayal. Professor Rob Ford from Manchester has been tweeting out these really interesting figures, lots of data, which just shows that that is a bit of a myth, that actually even in the seats that went Leave, Labour-held seats, that people are constantly invoking those kind of Caroline Flint, Northern Labour seats. There, actually, Remainers made up the majority of the Labour vote in that seat. And there's a risk, and Ford puts it quite interestingly, just because of the way the proportions work, that for every Remainer vote you lose because you did enable Brexit, that actually outweighs the two sort of Leave votes you might try and gain because of the way that the seat is disproportionately pro-Remain. So in the Labour vote. So I think there is, you know, that's why some people think the leadership is sort of covering their real motive, because the electoral reason doesn't really stack up, which is why people go back to this thing of, is it really the case that Corbyn, and particularly his circle, are Lexiters? You know, they are Brexiters for left-wing reasons, and the electoral stuff is a bit of a cover.
People close to Jeremy always say, for him at least, it's not something he's tremendously interested in. He'd rather be talking about other things, I think. Though there may be people around him who feel quite strongly about the Brexit issue, that's certainly true. I think he would like to move on and talk about austerity, you know, Tory cuts,
yeah,
all those other things, foreign policy, all those other things that exercise him.
I think that's half true, in the sense I don't think he's obsessive about the European Union for the reason a lot of people are, including Lexiters. It's not about, state aid and the economy. That's not what gets him out of bed in the morning. The idea that it is one big pillar of the West, and that the EU is to be bracketed alongside NATO and the IMF and all these hated Western institutions, that, I think, gets him going more. And you remember that speech that surfaced recently, that video from 2010? That was his thrust, you know, that the EU is a bad thing because it's part of this sort of Western architecture. So I think it's a bit of that going on. But yeah, I mean, you can imagine why they'd want it over with, but they just don't want to be blamed for it.
And Stephanie talked about, you know, having to go through the voting lobbies with Tories for Labour MPs. If this is going to be resolved, there's going to have to be some sort of cross-party working, isn't there? Which is not easy. It's particularly not easy for Theresa May or Jeremy Corbyn. That's not really their style. how does that happen, Rachel? People keep talking about Parliament taking control, but for Theresa May, who's repeatedly said, "Nope, we're coming out at the end of March. I won't delay it. It'll be fine." It's quite difficult, isn't it, to allow Parliament to take control in that way?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's very, very difficult, either generally in terms of cross-party working, but certainly with the kinds of individuals in charge right now, and indeed the kinds of individuals that are forming at least big chunks of the parties, to imagine it ever actually happening. I find the scenario basically impossible to envisage.
This is not making next week look very hopeful. We've got three votes, haven't we, potentially? Johnny, we've got the meaningful vote, two, MV2, as we're now forced to call it. Let's hope there isn't MV3. But then Theresa May has promised a vote on whether Parliament approves no deal and another one on whether it wants to extend Article 50. Both parties are going to face big problems, aren't they, in how to whip and how to handle those.
Yes, I mean, and also the sequencing is so important, and each vote is contingent in a way on the outcome of the vote before. So people's appetite for delay is partly a function of how big the defeat is on the meaningful vote. You know, if it's quite tight, and she doesn't lose as badly as, well, she can't lose as badly as she lost last time, 230 votes, it's going to be less than that. But if suddenly it seems as if, oh, hang on, she's quite close to getting this across the line, that's when I think that scenario I was talking about earlier might kick in, where people think, let's not vote for a delay, actually. Let's go for the 29th. If we come back here on the 27th, people are going to be so panicked that we're going over the edge, maybe she'll get her deal. So each one, actually, this is why it's like 27-dimensional chess. You know, each thing has a knock-on effect on the other one, and you can't game out what the coalitions will be. Depending, I just wanted to pick up Rachel's very good point about the personalities of the leaders. There was a launch this week for Rachel Reeves's book Women of Westminster, and it was a very sort of cross-party thing there, with Theresa May made a speech, but also Harriet Harman made a speech, you know. And so it was, and part of the theme was, you know, we women can work together, and who knows, there's 200 of us in Parliament, with that we could do all kinds of things. It was very revealing because Theresa May came in and gave this speech. But the second she'd finished it, she turned around and left the room again. So she could have stayed and mingled with a few colleagues, the sort of people who would be amenable to a conversation.
Yeah, I'm not sure that's a cross-party problem exactly. I think that's just a general problem.
Yes, that's right. It goes to her personality type. Yeah. That's what I mean. I think it goes to your point about her character. That there was just, it was just a demonstration there of how, I know people use this word clubbable, but this was in an environment where actually 5 minutes, she could have had a few conversations, you never know, but she came in, gave the speech and left again. There was no build-up, no exit. You know, it was just that. So
and
I thought it was indicative.
Is aspects of it are personal, and decisions do get oiled a bit, don't they, by these sort of personal relationships.
It's very interesting that, you know, she's now been Prime Minister for a while. This has been a well-noticed problem for a while, and she hasn't changed at all, right? Like, so you'd think that she'd have sort of forced herself into it by now, because we all know that it's a challenge for her, and she hasn't.
As you say, Jeremy Corbyn's not the most flexible.
He's not the most flexible man. No, that is very true. And, you know, that is the problem, is both of the parties currently both facing huge internal division and are led by people whose instinct is to put their head in the sand rather than actually try and deal with these problems.
Stephanie, can you see a route to a Labour government from this? Labour keeps saying the idea of trying to force a general election is still on the table. They haven't given up on that.
Well, the problem is, though, is if there is a general election, they do have to come up with a much clearer plan as to what they want to do. And at the last general election, they managed to sit on the fence quite beautifully, to be fair, and convince Leave voters that they were going to deliver Brexit and Remain voters that they were going to do everything they could to try and stop it. They're not going to have the same ability to do that. And I think with the current crisis going on in the Labour Party at the moment, I think it will be very, very difficult for them to get to number 10. But that is entirely in their hands and nobody else's.
This, by the way, is why I think, you know, if you were minded to place a bet, you might want to place it on delay of all the scenarios, because the Conservatives at some point may think the only other way out of this is an election. And the one thing they all agree on is they don't want that. And therefore, delay keeps everyone still in the game, keeps all options alive, and you can sort of live with it compared to the prospect of either losing Brexit or losing power or losing election. You know, so when it comes,
even though
to,
as Rachel said, the public might be horrified. Or
public would be horrified, but I could horrified. See a Rees-Mogg or someone saying, "Okay,
the least worst option."
So, yeah, the least worst option, exactly. Yeah.
Thank you all, and we'll be back after this. It's time to focus.
Well, I think that Democrats are going to have to contend with the fact that everything is about Donald Trump.
Today in Focus is the new daily podcast from The Guardian. Join me, Anushka Astana, for the best stories from our journalists around the world. Subscribe now to Today in Focus from The Guardian. Welcome back. Now, Labour MP Jess Phillips received an email from her son's school this week, which said it was planning to close early on Fridays from September to save costs. It also said it might be stopping provision for children with complex needs. Phillips was furious and took to Twitter to invite Theresa May to come to her constituency on a Friday and pick her son up from school. Chancellor Philip Hammond set some money aside in his autumn budget for what he called little extras for schools. Phillips tweeted at him, "Dear Philip Hammond, hashtag bleep your little extras." I sat down with Jess to find out more.
Jess, you quite often get a bit on the angry side, but you've got very angry this week, and it's because of government cuts that have affected you directly.
I am personally being affected by austerity, and austerity has affected members of my family before. Members of my family who are benefit dependent, who've been on disability benefits and lost them, like everybody. But specifically my own children's school this week has... it's been being talked about for a long time. The school has been suffering with financial constraints for a long, long time. But this week they have announced that they will shut at 1 o'clock every Friday as of September. And also, and the bit that hurts me actually the most, and the reason I wanted my children to go to this particular school, is because of the brilliant ethos that they have always had around disabled children. So in my son's class, there are two children in wheelchairs, and there are children with a whole range of other SEN issues, from autistic spectrum disorders to other behavioural issues that they may have to sensory deprivations. And my son has grown up with these children. In fact, my elder son, he was one of the SEN children. He doesn't go to that school anymore, he's too old. But the worst thing about what's been announced by the school this week is that they can no longer afford to backfill from their main school's budget the extra support that is needed that they used to receive from the government, which they no longer receive, specifically to maintain disabled children. And so my son's friends, there has to be some programme to cleanse them from the school. To me, this isn't a story in a newspaper. This is the children who come round to my house on a Saturday and play with my son, and they're his friends that he talks about at the end of the day. And this is all the children in my son's school, and it's a big primary school. It's all of their parents are going to have to find somewhere for their children to go on a Friday. And it's one of at least 10 schools in Birmingham. There's two in my constituency who have had to make this decision. This isn't a random one-off of bad management of one school. And the school my kids go to is in a relatively middle-class area for Birmingham. So this, again, is not something that is just, you know, inner city schools. The backlash I always get is, oh, it's because Birmingham's got loads of migrants and that's why there's, the schools can't cope with the birth rate and all that jazz. It's just simply not the case in my son's school, although there are already 32 and 33 children in every class in my son's school.
How is it legally possible to do it? How is the local education authority providing what it is meant to if it's sending kids home at lunchtime on a Friday?
Well, I mean, there is a set amount of hours legally that has to be done, and that is obviously something that I'll be taking up with the Department for Education in this case and every case of schools like this in Birmingham. But it doesn't matter what the law says. If you cannot afford to keep your doors open, and this, like I say, is not a new thing, this is what feels like a managed decline by the government of schools like my son's school. What can they do? They cannot afford to keep the support staff. They cannot afford to get the supply staff to ensure that the teachers can properly do the teaching in the time that they do have left. And it's a whole degradation. It's a degradation of the clinical psychologist that used to be in my son's school, which then leads that mainstream teachers then have to be pulled away to do some of the SEN work, some of the behavioural work, some of the pastoral care of kids with really complex lives, homeless kids, kids with difficult families. And so there used to be pastoral care and extra support for that. That gets taken away, so the teachers then have to do that as well as doing all the core and meet all their targets. There used to be police officers based in the schools in Birmingham to help with gang violence, which again we're seeing. That has totally been degraded again, leaving that level of intervention in children's lives and all the mental health crisis stuff that we hear all the time. It is just Everything has been degraded, leaving it entirely on the backs of teachers who are trying to get it done in the time, and it's just physically not possible. So when the DfE comes back with their ridiculous response that we have to make every pound count, there isn't...
Yeah, I was going to say, you often hear about waste, don't you? You hear we have to make difficult decisions and you know, we have to spend money more wisely. That tends to be the response.
Yeah, I mean, that is an absolute nonsense. There isn't a single teacher in my son's school who isn't going completely above and beyond the remit of their jobs. They are working with parents, they are helping families who've got no homes. These are social workers, they are mental health workers, they are still managing to get kids over the line on their English, maths and science. This is not lazy teachers not wanting to do their marking outside of hours, which they all do as a standard, always has. My dad was a teacher, that has always been the same. This is something entirely different. This is a total hollowing out of our society, and it hits places like where I live. It's not going to hit Windsor, where Theresa May lives. And actually, what thing that really bothers me about all of this is that the reason that they maybe aren't as exercised and aren't as annoyed about it is that the vast majority of the government will not be sending their children to mainstream schools. Their children aren't in the local comprehensives and the local primary schools. Mm. They probably give themselves a big tick and a pat on the back because they do send them to state primary. But, you know, the second they feel that it's going to change something, they're sending them off to fancy schools. And actually, where they're sending their kids to schools, they don't have high levels of deprivation. They don't have all of the other needs of what it's like to have a classroom full of children where, you know, a third of the children's parents are substance misusers, or they don't understand. They just think that the teachers where I live are lazy. My dad was an Ofsted inspector when Ofsted first existed, in fact, and he used to say to me, the roughest schools are always have the best teachers. Mm. They're the ones who are having to deal with all this stuff.
So every mum will have got one of those emails, would have been
absolutely
incredibly angry and frustrated.
Absolutely.
And upset.
Every mum and every dad, in fact.
Yeah,
I've had a lot
every
of
parent.
That, yeah.
What can you do about it? How can you use the platform that you have in this place to try and do something about it?
Well, what I will do, and, you know, this is an absolute warning to Philip Hammond, especially because we have the comprehensive spending review, which, again, is a totally nebulous thing, and whether it's actually ever going to come, because actually all of our civil servants are working on Brexit. So if we are to have a comprehensive spending review, I just want them to know that I am going to coach up all of the children from all of the Birmingham schools where Fridays have been put on. I will raise the money in, it will take me 10 minutes online to raise the money, and I will coach them here, and I'm going to leave them in the lobby of the Treasury, the lobby of the Department for Education, and I'm going to leave my own son with the police officers at Downing Street. Theresa May would not know what has hit her to have to spend even 25 minutes with my son, Danny. There is no greater pleasure at an equal time as there being no greater punishment. I tell you what, she wouldn't answer, you know, maybe actually her ability to answer a question with a completely robotic response will help, because he asks them at a rate of about a million a minute. So maybe they'll get on like a house on fire. But I think they need to see it. They need to see it physically. They need to understand what this means. This is not grains of sand. These are bodies of babies. And they have got to put them somewhere, and it is their responsibility to do that. The other thing that I think needs to be massively highlighted to them is the issue that in the exact same proximity as where I'm talking about schools not being able to cope with all of these things, three teenage boys were murdered less than a mile from my son's schools in the last 12 days. Mm. So at the same time, this whole degradation of our youth, of the future, of the people who live where I live, I want them to see it, and I want them to own it. And if Theresa May wants to tell me that police numbers have absolutely nothing to do with crime and school cuts and they're giving more money than ever to schools, well, it's not enough. You can keep saying it. Your stupid line is meaningless to me on a Friday afternoon. Meaningless. And also, I am much better at this than them, is what I would say to the government. I am much better liked. I am much better at communicating than literally every government minister. I mean, literally everyone, but on Theresa May levels, it's don't unleash this kraken, is what I would say to Theresa May today.
That is it.
Because this isn't amorphous to me. This is my life. This is my life. And you don't know people like me, maybe, but this is my life. And I'm going to shame you every single day until you do something about it.
Jess Phillips there. Rachel, you've worked on schools a lot. You advised David Cameron on education. You can't have foreseen a situation, can you, in which schools are closing at lunchtime to save money?
No, I mean, this is clearly a looming catastrophe. And we just talked about a potential general election. And one thing that was certainly very noticeable in the last general election, and I think will continue to be, is that actually when you get on the doorstep, there are just as many, if not more, people who want to talk about schools and hospitals as Brexit. And it is hard enough being a working parent managing a school hour from 8:30 to 3:45, that gets cut to 1 o'clock and it's over. So it seems to me that government has no choice but to make sure that these schools are able to stay open all day. Like, I can spend hours debating whether I think it makes sense how schools have spent the money they received since 2000 or not. But the truth is, if they're closing, then the Conservatives are going to have to give more money to sort it
out. And how has it come to this, do you think?
So I think the short answer is that what has happened is over the last kind of couple of decades is that schools have put huge amounts of money into additional staff. So there are far more things like teaching assistants in schools than you would have seen a couple of decades ago. It's almost impossible once you have those people in place to remove them, even though there's, you know, debatable evidence about how effective they are. It's basically impossible for a school to operationally do it. And so the only sort of easy choice, and I don't say easy meaning that it's an easy choice for them to make, but it's actually in some ways the fastest choice for them to make, is to shorten their hours. I mean, that's the simple answer. And the only sort of route, it seems to me, to solving this problem is to throw more money at it. Because, again, if you look at the last election, I was campaigning in the last election, the schools did a remarkably good job of campaigning and making clear to voters and parents that funding was a huge problem. And actually, for the first time, made it a real electoral issue. And it's now much worse than it was then in terms of what is happening to those schools. So they're just going to have to give them more money.
Yeah, it's a strong argument for Labour, isn't it? There's a sort of coherent narrative, which is we've had these, you know, however many years we are now, 8-9 years of austerity, and it's starting to bite, as Jess said, even fairly sort of, you know, middle class parents.
Well, this is it. And I think, you know, when you're kind of, you know, the Conservatives were desperate to just pull money out of everything. And I think, you know, there is a reality that then bites you, which is when you constantly, over a decade, rip funding out of vital public services, they then will start to struggle. And I think, firstly, it's an absolute testament to the public services we have in this country that it has taken this long for us to really feel the pain of lots of these. But this was an ideological decision. It was a decision of which the Tories decided they were going to do. And it was a route that they have ruthlessly pursued. And it does cut back to the Brexit debate in this sense. And this will also, in terms of Labour not being able to take any kind of leadership over that, this is the reality of what will happen. And if we leave with no deal, or we leave with a kind of bad deal, although I don't really think there is any particularly good deal, you will see this pain worsening for people across the country. And it was a referendum of which took most of the problems the Conservative government had created in Westminster, blamed them on Europe, and then said, if we leave Europe, this will solve the problems. And I think we are only going to see, and I think, you know, the comments that Rachel made earlier about do people feel like they've been lied to, I think that for me will be the moment that the country realises, and it won't be immediately, but it will be further down the line, that in all senses of that this was deeply necessary, these were the cuts that needed to be made, and leaving the European Union is what would solve them. That is a range of lies that I don't think the country are going to forgive the Conservatives, but they also won't forgive Labour if they don't do anything of which to stop this.
I think one thing that's very noticeable, again, if you sort of talk to people around the country, is, and it shows up in the approval polls, the more people see of Jeremy Corbyn, the less they like of him. And things like anti-Semitism are starting to really cut through for the first time. So he's starting from a poor position. But what do people really care about? They care about the things they rely on, the services and the jobs that they rely on functioning. And so the biggest own goal for the Conservatives is to allow really totemic things, and 4.5 day week school is a really totemic thing. It's quite extreme to happen, because it is actually, I think, the one thing that really could give the keys to Downing Street to Corbyn.
I thought that for all those reasons, Philip Hammond's intervention on today, Thursday as we speak, where he said to Tory backbenchers, look, there is a pot of money there. I could spend it to alleviate these problems, which you're all going to feel the political heat of, schools closing early, you know, insufficient police numbers. I could do that. But otherwise, but if you take us to no deal, I'm going to have to spend that money on mitigating the effects of a crash out no deal. You choose. I thought that was quite an effective political, move by him. And I was thinking, if I were a Tory backbencher weighing these things up, I'd be thinking, you know, I don't love the backstop and all that. But on the other hand, if he's got a big dollop of money, that is going to keep, not just keep my seat, but actually change the weather for the next 2-3 years, where otherwise, as we've just been hearing, it will all be about this sort of death by a thousand cuts. It will be every local, your local constituency newspaper will be about the school closing at one, the child, you know, heaven forbid, who was stabbed, etc. The police station that's closed. What would you choose if you were working out what's the better option for you? And so I thought that was quite an effective move by Hammond, and may have an effect on MV2.
Well, and it just so happens that he has his spring statement next week, I think on the same day as the deal, no deal vote. So he's got another opportunity at the dispatch box to make that argument. And I think we'll probably hear quite a bit more of that. Okay, thanks all. Now, after surviving no confidence votes from her own MPs and the opposition, Theresa May is in theory secure in her role until the end of the year. But rumours abound that she'll be forced to stand down after the local elections in May, and various members of the cabinet look to be on manoeuvres. Former Brexit Secretary David Davis told Tatler magazine last week he had the credentials for the top job. Amber Rudd very publicly mutinied against a no-deal Brexit. Gavin Williamson tried talking tough to China. And Boris Johnson has a new haircut. So who's jostling to be the next Prime Minister? Rachel, in the latest Conservative Home survey, it's Boris Johnson still who comes top, Dominic Raab second, and Michael Gove third. So all Brexiters in the front running, but it's going to matter quite a lot what alliances people make, isn't it?
Well, I mean, I think the two very obvious points is there's always a huge difference between who members will vote for in the final two. Like, I think it's easy to forget that actually it was quite likely Andrea Leadsom was going to win in a members vote. Like, it's easy to forget that.
MPs whittle it down to two, don't they?
MPs whittle it down to two, and MPs tend to have a very different view from members. And the second thing to your alliance is I can't think of a recent predictable Conservative leadership election. So, you know, Hague defenestrated, Howard, no one predicted, Cameron, certainly no one predicted the Boris Michael Gove blow up. So what seems sort of much more probable is that there will be a series of assassinations, some highly predictable, some not, that whittle it down to a final two. And if one of those final two is a Brexiter, then they will almost certainly win.
To think that it's automatically going to fall to Boris, which still gets said around the place.
It seems increasingly unlikely, not impossible, because I think the Conservatives are often more pragmatic than other parties, and they like people who they think will win. It's not impossible Boris will make it to the final two, but fewer and fewer people think he would win. So it seems to me much more likely that he would fail to get to the final two. If he did, I think he'd almost certainly win.
Could it be someone from a younger generation?
Yes, always. But I don't think it's necessarily the predictable people from the younger generation. And we've seen a lot of people on manoeuvres, Johnny Mercer giving what I have to say I found quite unintelligible statement about sand and racehorses today, arguing for a new generation. And every MP always believes they can be leader. Like, whatever they say in public, they always believe they can be leader and should be leader. So you'll get a huge number of manoeuvres. I think it partly depends on when, because the longer this runs, the more you're going to see senior people get damaged and toppled one by one. You know, someone like Sajid Javid is sort of always one disaster off being toppled.
Yeah, so it's a dangerous job, Home Secretary, isn't it?
It's a very dangerous job. So if you're seeing a leadership election in quite a long time, it seems to me much more likely you'll get young people through, because every single senior people will be too damaged by government.
Johnny, she's so personally associated with this deal, Theresa May, isn't she? And with the promise that she'll deliver Brexit on time. Is it difficult for her to stay on if the outcome is something different?
It should be. And yet, oddly, in her case, I don't think it would be difficult. And that's because she has this kind of odd and paradoxical Teflon quality. Normally, when you talk about a politician as a Teflon coating, that usually means they're riding so high, they're so strong, that everything just bounces off them. And Ronald Reagan had a bit of that. She has the reverse. It's a kind of, you know, Superman bizarro Teflon, which means that her standing is so low that almost nothing she can do can take it any lower. So, for example, she has broken so many promises. She said famously there would be no early election, no snap election. And then there was, and she lost, threw away a majority. Normally that would mean your career's over. She carried on. She said that, you look, the bill, the withdrawal agreement I've negotiated, you cannot possibly change that. You cannot alter it. There's nothing to be done. And then, flip of a coin, suddenly she's voting, urging people to vote for the Brady Amendment, saying it can be changed. You know, meaningful vote will happen on December the 11th, I think was the date. And then she just pulled it a month later. So she breaks promises all the time. And I think I could just see her having, and it's also oddly the other side of this incredible Maybach quality of hers, is that she can just say the opposite of what she said a week ago and do it with a complete brass neck, you know, without seeming even aware of the contradiction. So I can imagine her looking us in the eye and saying, I know I told you it'd be March 29th, but it's not going to be. And on we go. And there's so many people who think a delay will be quite convenient. I don't think she'd get that much grief for it.
And meanwhile, Stephanie, there's this extraordinary manoeuvring going on constantly, isn't there? I had a coffee with the cabinet minister earlier this week who was saying how exhausting it was that you sit round the cabinet table and, you know, everybody makes their little speech and you can tell which is the bit that will be briefed to media afterwards as their sort of masterful intervention.
Oh, I can imagine. And as I mean, you know, there is a difference between the Conservative and Labour way of which they select their leaders. Within the Conservative Party, it's much more about, as we say, whittling down to two, and it's the parliamentary party that do that. So I can only imagine the level of exhaustiveness that goes in and around all of that. But I agree with Jonathan. I think she will be safe. Her ability to just kind of keep going is now, although I think for the sake of the country, somewhat terrifying. I think that will, however, stop when they feel like there will be the next election, or it is the time for them to call another election. Because the only way she saved her job when there was the no confidence vote was to say, look, I know how badly I did the last election. I will, however, deliver Brexit. That can be on me. And then we can have someone new come through for the next election. And I think that is when the Conservative Party will need to make a real choice as to what future they want to go down. Do they want to go with someone younger, someone who can seem to be more modernising, someone who can try and unite more of the country and kind of build that coalition in the way that they kind of tried to get David Cameron to do, and in a way he was mildly successful? Or will they go down that kind of more UKIPisation of the Conservative Party and more of that kind of hardline Brexiteer? And I think, you know, that at the moment is the real thing. Everyone talks about the kind of divisions within the Labour Party, which are plainly true to see, but there is also huge division now in terms of the Conservative Party and the future of them and where they go.
And so the one qualifier on that would be about how long the extension would be and what would it would be for. So if it's a 3-month extension, I think absolutely what Stephanie said is completely right, and they certainly don't want her to fight an election, but they wouldn't topple it before then. If, however, this is the really long extension, like 2 years in which they negotiate the full future relationship with Europe, I can't imagine the Tories letting her or wanting her to do that.
Because in a sense, she's had her go.
She's not that effective. But also, they will, I think, you know, the Brexiters will want someone who's a Brexiter to do that. I don't think they would trust her again to do that. So in general, I've thought they're ready to let her soldier on with the proviso, exactly as Stephanie says, that she mustn't ever be allowed anywhere near an
election. No one
wants
to get back on that strong and stable battle bus.
They do not want that. And that was obvious even before, actually, the election. I wrote something saying this will be her last election. They won't let her do that again. But I think if they're looking, staring down the barrel of this going on till 2021, negotiating the full future relationship with a new European Commission president, and because the whole, after European elections, the whole commission will change, I somehow think they would say we need someone else.
And Stephanie, who's most, when you look at the various challenges, who would be most worrying for Labour, do you think? Who's capable of sort of, you know, remaking the Tories' image and you know, really challenging Labour?
I mean, I have no idea where they'll kind of end up in terms of who they'll pick. But I think, you know, for me, I think it is someone who is seen to be more compassionate, the ability of which to kind of bring people together, someone who is younger, who isn't tainted with the kind of depth of austerity and the reality of austerity that would have been seen by the last government. I think that is going to be the only way they really kind of shield some of that off and kind of be able to kind of pull through it. But as I say, that, you know, one the kind of gossip that I'm never privy to really is lots of the Conservative gossip. It's a different world. But
but meanwhile, Johnny, we get in the ensuing months, we get to watch these sort of short-lived fireworks of this person is the next big thing. Oh, Gavin Williamson, who was up and coming and is now sending gunboats to China and offering to send the troops in to sort knife crime and all sorts of other
things. The best person probably to get, you know, Labour into government next would be Chris Grayling. I mean, I don't trust the man to go and buy me a cup of coffee, let alone anything else. So let's see where it goes.
Okay, thanks all. Well, that's all we have time for this week. My thanks to all our guests, Jonathan Friedland, Stephanie Lloyd and Rachel Wolfe. The producer was Simon Barnard. I'm Heather Stewart. Thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.